Welcome to the NBA Jam Podcast with your host, Avinash Bajaj.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the NBA Jam. This is founder and owner of the NBA Jam, Avinash Bajaj. It has been a very long time since I've recorded an interview, but I made an exception in this case because of the speaker, and I really wanted to get this interview in. Today, we're speaking to Dr. Christopher Abraham. He is currently the CEO and head of the Dubai campus of FPJ School of Global Management, which is a very renowned university for MBA. It's ranked in the top 100, I believe, at some point of time. It has campuses in Dubai, Singapore, Mumbai, and Sydney. Dr. Abraham obviously has a long list of awards and recognitions. I'm not going to go into each one of them. And at this point of time, maybe I just want to introduce him. And Dr. Abraham, how would you like to describe yourself to start off with?
Well, a lover of humanity, a teacher by heart, and a lifelong learner. So in the process, I keep winning these accolades. But I think at the end of the day, I'd love to be of some use to humanity, and in the process, learn something on a continuous basis. That's how I'd like to describe myself.
Wow, that is quite something. Dr. Abraham, so how long have you been doing this particular role that you're doing? And how did you come upon to do this?
So a total of 36 years of professional experience. Started in India way back in 1986, soon after I finished my MBA. Had the lucky break, I would say a fortunate break, to be a part of a consulting firm. So I've done some very interesting work in the consulting space. I was part of a team that launched Titan Watches to the world at large. I was part of a team that launched Moods Condoms. I've done work with the Government of India, National Biogas Program, National Family Welfare Program, so on and so forth. 1995, I moved out to the Gulf, to Dubai to be more precise. And for the last 26 years, have made Dubai my second home, though I have a home in Canada as well. And it's been a fantastic roller coaster ride with lots of ups and downs. I used to head the XLRI program in Dubai. I was heading the executive MBA there, which is when SP Jain approached me way back in 2004. I joined them as part of the founding team. So I had the privilege of being part of this fabulous journey right from day zero, because I was employee number one. I established the campus in Dubai, was invited to set the campuses in Dubai and Singapore and Sydney. So it's been an absolutely fascinating ride with lots of excitement and lots of achievements. And it's been thanks to the visionary leadership of our president, Mr. Nitish Jain. We have had no turning back. And as we speak, our next standalone campus is already established in the city of London. And if all goes well, God willing, we'll have our next campus in Silicon Valley. So that's been the journey. I've been with them for the last 18 and a half years. A total of, almost 50% of my professional career I've spent with SP Jain. I'm also a professor. I teach cross-disciplinary subjects like the neuroscience of decision-making, design thinking, positive psychology, the science of happiness, leadership, organizational behavior. And I cross different disciplines and give participants a multidisciplinary perspective. I'm also actively involved in consulting, still with governments, with the World Bank, with Emirates Airlines, Nissan, to name just a few. And I have done some work in the space of consulting with governments as well. Government of Nigeria, Singapore, Dubai, UAE, and of course, India.
Oh, perfect. No, that is quite a lot. And yeah, almost half your career in one particular role. That's fantastic. So you mentioned very interestingly that you also teach neuroscience decision making. Really interesting. In my last startup, I was trying to build a product that is focused on decision making. So, you know, maybe next time you get a chance to grab a coffee, you know, I'll dig further into that. That's really interesting. So just, and my history is a bit rusty over here. So SP Jain, does it do only MBA or do you do other courses as well?
Okay, SP Jain and its Indian avatar, which was started in the 1981, is a purely business-focused business school among the top 10, as you know, in India. 2004, when we set our sights beyond India, Dubai being the first destination, we started off as a business school. and we're doing pretty well for ourselves. The Financial Times rankings, The Economist, The Forbes, The Wall Street Journal, The Times Higher Education, we're all in the space of business education. But during the decade after, we realized business does not exist without technology. And technology has no relevance if it's not applied in a business context. Yeah. So right from 2015 onwards, we started also looking at technology. We set up centers for excellence in fintech, blockchain, machine learning, artificial intelligence, so on, and big data, and so on and so forth. And then realized that they don't work in isolation, that they work in tandem. So then started programs combining elements of cutting-edge technology with business. So as we speak, we have a top-notch bachelor's in data science in business. We have an excellent program on master's in artificial intelligence in business. Both these are accredited by the Australian government, like all our other degree programs. In addition, we run multi-campus programs in undergraduate, master's and MBA levels. And not forgetting, we have one of the largest executive MBA programs in the world. And in the last 4 years, we've also launched the doctorate in business administration. So these are our regular qualification-based programs across business and technology. And as I said earlier, we also are in the space of corporate and executive training and education. So that's another big space that we work on.
Got it. That's quite a lot. So how are you delivering these courses at the moment, most of them? Are you going more hybrid now because of where the world is going, or are you trying to get people back to campus?
Yeah. Again, a very interesting question. Again, thanks to the visionary leadership of SP Jain, much before COVID could come in, we invested in a very interesting technology called Engaged Learning Online. In fact, there's a couple of fascinating videos on YouTube you can watch. The key word is not online, it's engagement. So right from eye contact to interactivity to quizzes to polls, you name it, we have it all. And we could see all the students in one shot, unlike Zoom. And where the students can see all of us, including the professor, the whole range. I mean, it's completely engaged and completely interactive. That was a huge hit. And ironically, when we launched it, we hardly had any takers. Because the world was normal and people were not too keen on the online versions. Now, that's an open confession. But guess what? When COVID hit us, we had to shift to online. And we were much more prepared than most other universities and B-schools. So we just went on, transitioned to the online. And boy, we started with one studio in each of our four campuses. Currently, we have three in Dubai, three in Mumbai, two in Singapore, and two in Sydney. So it's been a fantastic transformation from the traditional mode to online. Then when things got better, we had the hybrid version where students could opt to come over to campus because Dubai was open long back, 2020 September, as you know, we opened up. And then Singapore opened slowly. Now recently, Sydney has also opened. But little by little, we started opening. So we had all these options available, online only, hybrid, online plus face-to-face, and the face-to-face model, depending on the expectations and requirements of the different students.
And yeah, still exactly. Continue.
Yeah.
No, that's super interesting because I think obviously I did my MBA very long time ago, almost 12 years ago, and different world back then. But I think the interesting thing is during COVID, when I was speaking to students, they really felt a bit shortchanged by the experience in different universities. I'm not talking about SP Jain, because a lot of people do, at least a lot of people think they want to do MBA because of the network, want to start meeting more people. And that became a bit harder to do online. But I suppose hybrid may be useful because, you get the theoretical education, online, but you also have the opportunity to network. So how are you seeing changes in perception in terms of how students are coming in? Are you seeing changes as the world is slowly being a bit different?
Okay. Let me go back in time. Let me explain the rationale, the scientific rationale behind why we had these multi-campus experiences. So let me start with a fascinating experiment done many years back in Cornell University. Cornell, as you know, is a very respected university. Even in the recent rankings, it's among the top 20 in the world. a fascinating experiment to see whether multinational exposure actually changes people's approach to problem solving and decision making. So they did a very simple experiment. They had three categories of people. One group of people who were all American, one group who were, let's say, had America and another country as exposure. Third group, which had multi-country exposure. All three groups were given the same problem. It's called the famous or infamous Dunker candle problem. A candle, a box of matches, a set of brass tacks. The challenge for the participant is to fix the candle on a wall and light up the candle and ensure that the wax from the candle does not drip on the ground. Sounds simple. It's one of the most baffling problems that the human mind can perceive. So here are the results. 18% among the America only cracked the problem. 32% almost double cracked the where they were two country exposure. And the multi-country exposure people had a humongous 67% success rate. Now, neuroscience has an answer to it. Every time you go to a new place, every time you're exposed to a new culture, every time you're exposed to a new business practice or environment, your brain is rewiring. It's actually forming new neurons and forming new neural connections. At that point of time, it doesn't really know what to do with it, but it's absorbing all of this because the brain is a fascinating absorption mechanism. Now, fast forward 1 year, 2 years down the line, the same student who's gone through these multi-campus, multicultural experiences is now working for a global company with multiple, let's say, global challenges. Now the brain is a pattern maker and a dot connector. It is connecting all the dots and bringing out as, hey, this is what we did in Dubai. This is what we did in Singapore. This is what we saw in Sydney. So that connection helps, right? So Harvard has a fascinating term for it. It's called global intelligence. So what we have done is we have embedded global intelligence as part of a curriculum. And then came COVID. Now, the second part of the question you asked. Then came COVID online. Again, what we did, we were conscientious of our business proposition, our value proposition. Our value proposition is these multi-country, multi-campus, multicultural experiences. So when we went online, here is the difference between us and the rest. I don't want to name names. What we did was conscientiously realize that could we replicate an experience as multicultural and multi-country like our face-to-face programs. So what we did was we partnered with our own existing partner schools. We looked at new partner institutions. So even our online program had enough and more opportunities for our students to interact on a global scale. The only difference, of course, was digital. And I, as a behavioral guy, would still prefer face-to-face. But that was better than a conventional. So our, you know, again, I will send you the link if time permits, or you can check it out. Hello. It's completely different. It's a different, let's say, level of interactivity and engagement. So one, we had global partners, we had global students, we had global countries, which interacted with our students, with our faculty. So it was a replication of our global intelligence program. Of course, minus the face-to-face you know, interaction or physical interaction. But I think we were conscious about it. So that did help. I wouldn't still say it can replace the conventional, you know, going to a place, immersing yourself and enjoying the sights and the sounds. But certainly it made a difference.
No, that so is absolutely, no, absolutely fascinating. You know, the Dunker, what's the full experiment?
The Dunker candle problem. Dunker is a professor who gave it. You just Google the Dunker, you'll find it. There's lots of interesting.
Oh, fantastic. No, that's really interesting. I mean, that speaks volumes in terms of the need for diversity and inclusion in teams as well. I mean, I've been working, I live in London right now. I've been working in London for the last 12 years. In spite of that, I see a lot of boardrooms that are not diverse. I see a lot of leadership teams that are not diverse. But in my experience, whenever I have worked with teams that are more diverse, I agree with you. The creativity levels are always higher and the productivity always is higher. But I think that speaks volumes. That's a really good segue in terms of, you mentioned in terms of, you know, the competitive edge or the competitive advantage that you have. I mean, I know you don't want to name names, but obviously from India, you know, I've always been fascinated by the IIMs, you know, because they have been dominating in terms of, you know, the courses and the future a lot of people end up having. But one thing that's always bothered me is that I've always found, at least in my experience, I've found the IIMs very non-diverse, you know, because they have people from similar backgrounds, similar experiences, And at the same time, yeah, I found a lot of universities have focused on diversity. Any thoughts on that? Obviously, and I don't want to put you in a spot where you have to, speak down on anyone else. But yeah, any thoughts on that? It looks like the diversity factor is very, it's very thoughtful and intentional rather than something that just came about.
You know, again, I just wanted to make a small clarification on that word diversity. I mean, conventionally, we use it very loosely. But if you look at it from a behavioral science perspective, backed up by research from neuroscience and cognitive psychology, the diversity that we really need in a team, yes, if you can have, let's say, gender diversity, racial diversity, religious diversity, nationality diversity, that's fine. But the key factor with all these differentiators is what we call cognitive diversity, which is in the thinking process. And that, of course, happens if I have a diverse background. You know, a Russian doesn't think like an Azerbaijani doesn't think like an Argentinian doesn't think like an Indian. So, yes, it brings it. But the key factor there is cognitive diversity. And one of the best examples for this kind of diversity is the design firm IDEO. Is one of the top, respected design firms, as you know. These were the guys who actually started the Stanford Design School, the Design Thinking School, but phenomenal in terms of their diversity. So if they want to look at a technical problem, you would have a literature, you would have a medical doctor, you would have a rocket scientist, you would have a historian. And so imagine a historian bringing his perspective to the same technical problem vis-a-vis a doctor, vis-a-vis a rocket scientist, vis-a-vis a literature. That's the kind of diversity. And that has made them probably, in my opinion, the most respected design firm in the world. Now back to the Indian scenario. For whatever reasons, probably it's high time we start thinking of how do Indian, top Indian, schools, not only in business, even in other disciplines, how do we attract some of the world's best talent to come over to us? And let's not forget the fact, I keep reminding our people all the time, way before anybody could do it, we had the Nalandas and the Taxilas. And we had people flying in from, not flying, because we didn't have flights at the time. We had people traveling from Greece and China. And if you know your geography, these are two parts of the world. They would come over to India to study. So we had, the Taxilas and the Nalandas way before people talked about global education. So we have a heritage, a legacy. I think it's time for us to go back to that legacy. Create India. I'm at the end of the day, I might live in Dubai or you might live in London, but at root, at heart, we are Indian. So we want India to shine so we can get some of the best people to come across to India. Why not? Today, you have a HCL that attracts multinationals. You have TCS, which has international employees. You have an INFI that has it, Infosys, Wipro. So there is this huge realization. Some of our world's best CEOs are Indians. So I think there is a new realization that is creeping in. And I think it's time for educational institutions to actually leverage that advantage. Notwithstanding the current uproar and furor that's going on, which I hope and pray ends very soon. But I think we have a lot to offer to the world as a nation because of our remarkable heritage and remarkable history. So to answer that question, I think those Indian institutions could do a lot more to attract some of the best talent. So it'll be fascinating if we could do that. For example, in our undergraduate program, we have almost about 48 to 50% of the cohort, which is international. In an Indian business school, technically we're Indian, though we're Australian by legality. So we have Indonesians, we have French, we have Norwegians, we have German, we have Mexicans, we have Nicaraguans. So look at the diversity. You're talking about Asians, Europeans, Africans, North and South Americans, a fascinating array of, and imagine for a teacher who's able to teach that kind of a diverse group, we learn a lot from these people. Forget about we teaching them. We learn a lot from those diverse people. So it's fascinating. So there's no two questions about it. I would even say from a larger global perspective, the more diverse, the more appreciative we are of different cultures, the more we become inclusive, the more we become tolerant, the more we become acceptable to each other. All these parochial, conflicts could be mitigated to a very large extent if you're able to, understand that, I would say, synchronicity in this diversity.
Yeah, no, fantastic. I think that's really interesting. 48-50%. Yeah, I think that's fantastic, I would say. So it's a good segue to one of my other questions I had is that, you know, where do most of your students come from? So obviously you mentioned some of the countries they come from, but in terms of, you know, professional background or education, like just as not exact statistic, because I'm sure we can find that on your website somewhere, but just your thoughts, like where do most of these come from? Because let's say, you know, people who are maybe considering, you know, doing a business course, it'll be interesting for them to understand, you know, whether this is a good fit for them or not.
Yeah, see, there are two, I would say, categories of people. One is a traditional business house who wants to send their wards to a top-notch global education where they get exposed and they come back. That's one category. But I think a larger segment, and that's a very, let's say, a heartwarming reality for us, come from typical middle-class families with those big dreams and aspirations. And here's the best part. Many of them can't afford the fees for this program, you know, which is slightly on the higher side because of the global nature. But here's the thing. We do have tie-ups with a few banks. Most of them take loans, man, within a couple of years. They repay the loans. And here's the best part. After they have repaid the loans, there's this huge itch for them to branch out on their own. So many of them, after completing their loan formalities, start up businesses on their own. And that's very heartening. So they start off as job seekers. Within a few years, 3 to 5 years, many of them become job creators. And it's even more heartening when the same people who took jobs through the campus placement now come to campus to recruit for their own companies. That's fascinating.
That is very satisfying, isn't it?
Very satisfying.
Because that means they're actually helping pay it forward. They're actually helping the community. They're actually making a name for themselves and giving confidence, you know, the people who are, you know, considering. It's like, look, we have managed to move quite a bit forward.
Very true. Very true.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. So, yeah, it's very interesting.
So these are not the people who have lots of money, but they have lots of dreams, lots of aspirations, a lot of passion to make a difference and grow in life. So these are your, you know, typical people with a fire in the belly. And we, you know, ignite that and make them satisfy their dreams.
Fantastic. No, that's really good to hear. In fact, that's again, a very good segue into another question is that, where do most of them typically end up going to, you know, and in terms of, you mentioned some of them might create their own businesses, you know, at some point of time, but then generally what kind of industries or what kind of roles do most of them end up, or maybe not most, like generally what's your feeling, like so, where do they end up?
Yeah. So one is, you know, pertaining to the specialization choices we have, which are in finance, global finance, global logistics and supply chain management, contemporary and global marketing management. And off late, we've also started a track on e-business. And we're probably one of the few schools, I don't think there's any other school in the world that offers consulting as a specialization in the MBA. So we do have an MBA consulting. And these are the broad tracks available, which means the jobs would pertain to these industries. So from financial analysts to private bankers, investment bankers, banking professionals, marketing in all its shapes and colors, logistics and supply chain, where we have an extremely strong program. E-business, again, you know, you have this huge market opportunity for e-businesses, commerce, e-commerce. So those would be the broad segments. And consulting, of course, the big five and the rest of the consulting industry would be very happy to look at someone who is trained in the fine art of consulting. So that again works. And notwithstanding, some people by choice would go back to their family businesses to help out dad or uncle or family businesses and go back. So that's the broad mandate. But by virtue of our locations, Dubai, Singapore, Sydney, we would also have opportunities for them in each of these cities, subject to the student wanting to be in these places. So we asked them, what would be the location choice you like? Some by choice would like to go back to India because of family considerations, whatever, personal reasons. Some would like to stay in Dubai. A lot of people get jobs in Dubai. Dubai is a very, very, let's say, growing place with enough opportunities across sectors. So people like to do that. Plus, Dubai has zero tax, corporate tax. There's a 5% general tax, which is VAT, which is for products. But other than that, we don't pay any tax. So if you earn, say, 10,000 dirhams or 20,000 dirhams, that's money straight into your pocket. And if you have a habit of sending back money, again, Dubai is one of the largest transshipment centers for sending money back home. Zero tax, 100% repatriation of funds. So these are attractive, extremely exciting lifestyle. And now off late, they've also started giving long-term visas for specialist categories like professors, scientists, lawyers, IT professionals, and so on and so forth. So students also get an opportunity to stay back for longer durations. Otherwise, these are three-year periods, unlike in Australia, UK, where you have opportunities to convert into PR. But now they have come out with this golden visa scheme, which means a minimum of 10 years, renewable every 10 years is possible, which is also a very attractive option for...
Absolutely. I think that's good because I think when I came to UK, we had lesser time period. I think 1, 2 years and 3 years. I don't know what it was. That's always a problem because then you're always under a bit of undue pressure to go and pick the first opportunity you see instead of essentially the right opportunity.
All right, cool. So I think those are fantastic insights,
Dr. Abraham. So I think switch gears a little bit. And I think all your insights so far were, from the perspective of an educator and the perspective of someone who's leading the program. One thing I was really curious to hear about is, let's say you are either a student already at SPJN or you've just passed out. And let's say, I'm someone who's considering SPJN. What are some of the top tips or advice you have for me, as someone who's probably just done the course? Like, what are some of the things that I should consider, whether or not I want to apply?
First is the open mind. You need to have an open mind about the changes that take place. You might take advice from different people, could be friends, relatives, a successful uncle, whatever. But at the end of the day, the final decision should be yours after you doing your due diligence and homework, which means analyze, get to know the blogs, check with the existing students, alums. The more homework you do, the more convinced you are. And another important tip. You see, people consider, and this is a very wrong, I would say, a very Asian kind of thing, where students look at careers based on the size of the money bag. I'm sorry to say this. I have a lot of parents who come and say, Prof, tell us, you have marketing, you have finance, you have so on and so forth. Which should my son take? The next question will really irritate you. Which one pays the most? And the moment I have this, seriously, it's a very sad reflection of our understanding. So I tell them, first of all, that with very, very, simple, in a dignified manner, without hurting their sentiments, I'll tell them, that's probably the wrong question. And I mean it. I'll tell you why. You might make tons of money, but are you happy doing it? And then I validate this with a very simple but extremely profound Chinese proverb. Happiness is doing what you love to do and getting paid for it. So it's a combination of passion plus the results or the returns that come. So whenever I speak to students, I tell them, before you decide what you want to do, find out what is it that excites you. Is it finance? Is it marketing? Is it IT? Is it consulting? So you choose that. Do that homework. How do you do that homework? Do a couple of Google searches. Find out, is this what you want to do? What are the roles? What are the job descriptions? So do that homework. Or if you don't do it, it doesn't matter. Come with an open mind. Don't say, I want to become this hotshot investment banker because my uncle's making tons of money being an investment banker. No, that's the wrong way to look at it. Would you like doing it? And then we would advise them during the interview phase, during the counseling phase, and even before they get into the program, we advise them what choices they should make. Because that choice, please remember, is going to determine his career, his future. If he's taking finance, he's going to look at careers in finance. If he's taking logistics, he's going to look at supply chain careers. So he has to be extremely diligent when they do that. That's point number one. Point number two, the understanding of the brain. A lot of us say, finance requires lots of numbers. I'm passionate about it, but I don't think I can do numbers. But here's the revelation. We all have an amazing God-given brain, which has a right side and a left side. Many of us put one side to sleep. So if you're a numbers guy, you'll put the right side to sleep. If you're a creative guy, you'll put the left side to sleep. The reality is that we have both these things can function equally well as long as we train it. There are simple exercises on a regular basis. When you do, both brains work. So even if you don't have that penchant for numbers, but you feel that you love doing it, please start working on it now. The third tip I would give, which in our times we never had, probably even you didn't have at your time, is this opportunity of an open knowledge source. So today, now let's take a typical example. I'm a bachelor's. I've done my bachelor's. Now I'm considering SP Jain's MBA. I think finance is a good option for me. But before I take that decision, can I dabble in a few subjects absolutely free of cost? So join one of those MOOCs, the massive online open courseware. Free of cost. You don't need to pay for it because you don't need the certificate at the moment. You're only seeing how good or how exciting that particular subject is. After you dabble in a few subjects and say, hey, man, this is awesome. This is what I want to do. Then maybe what you can also do, you can repeat that course as a paid version, because in the paid version with a few $100, you not only go through the regimen of the assignments and homework and the final exam or reflective paper, you get a certification after you complete it. So by the time you come to the interview to SP Jain for MBA Finance, you're saying, listen, sir, I was a BSc Math. I did these couple of courses in Coursera. Two of them I did without the certification. Two I've done with certification. You are telling me a lot about yourself. You're now saying I've done my homework. I know, because one of the common questions we would ask is, why do you want to do finance? Why do you want to do supply chain? Why do you want to do marketing? And don't go around the bush, giving all kinds of funny cock and bull stories. Tell them what you've really done and why you want to do it, because you've done your homework. So being open, putting your left and right brain to work, investing in massive online open courseware, and that world is continuous. I learn at this age, 60 plus, I still learn. I still invest time into my learning. I don't need certifications, but for the knowledge's sake, I learn. And I think we all need to do that. Learn, unlearn, relearn. Continuously, lifelong. If you keep doing that, you'll never become redundant. You'll never need to worry about AI. Yeah, one day robots will steal my job. No, if you're a few steps ahead, and if you can concentrate on human-only skills, which AI will find it extremely difficult to replicate, I think you're way ahead of the curve. And of course, invest in technology. So if you're a marketing guy, learn marketing analytics. If you're a supply chain guy, learn about IoT and learn about warehouse distribution management systems. If you're a finance guy, learn crypto, blockchain, fintech. So that's the kind of relevant investment into your technology as well that you have to do, which can happen. Don't wait for SP Jain to give you that. You can start doing it. The moment you decide it, I think they should start doing it. Notwithstanding whether they join SP Jain or any school, they have invested in their development on an ongoing basis.
Yeah. That's really interesting. You mentioned about, the open knowledge. Yeah, I agree. During my time, I didn't really have the opportunity to do much of it. Like I still remember at one point of time in high school back then, and maybe that's why I'm a bit cynical of the Indian education system, but I guess no education system is perfect anywhere. But in high school, I wanted to learn commerce. And I was in the computer science stream. And I said, hey, that's really interesting. I want to understand, what macroeconomics and, what commerce is. And at that point, I had a conversation with my teacher. And she was like, you'll have to switch streams from computer science to commerce. And my point was, why do I need to switch? Why can't I learn both? Can't I actually absorb a lot? So I think it's really interesting you mentioned that, because I think the biggest challenge, especially speaking to the parents, is suddenly they're like, hang on, they should do this and that? No. I want them to be an engineer. I want them to be, medical field. Like, so how does that work? So I think you're right. There's a bit of a mindset shift and a cultural shift that needs to happen. And it's a good point. You need to start that maybe a little before. You're and at the point of decision making.
Yeah, just to validate that, this thought process, I think parents need to be enlightened. There is a fascinating book by an Indian author from Oxford University. It's called Fluid. You might want to read it, which is two parts. One part is the attack on the traditional Indian education system, which is obsessed with just a few areas to focus on. But if you look at the history of the greatest contributors to arts and science, these are people whom we loosely call polyglots. But Professor argues that polyglots are not some special category of people. It's just that those people did everything, you know, looked at a wider range of stuff. He calls it fluid intelligence. So we should not box ourselves into, you know, an engineering brain or a math brain or a medical brain or a commerce brain. In fact, this cross-disciplinary thinking is today coming very strongly across disciplines. And we are seeing this. See, for example, a modern medical doctor needs to know as much of engineering, the use of technology, as much as he understands patient care. So he can't just be just somebody who understands anatomy. He needs to know how to use those sophisticated equipments, data analytics, so on and so forth. So I think that openness parents now need to have, which will then rub off on teachers, because teachers can't do much without parents' support. So it's a three-way process. The kid is stuck in between. He or she, you know, wants to do a whole lot of things, like you said. I want to do commerce and I want to also do computer science. Well, we need to provide those options available. And I hope in the new education policy that India has launched, there is a little more openness towards it. You can't box things. Plus, I'll give you another revelation. You see, the traditional four-year education is almost now being questioned for its relevance. Because by the time the child finishes the fourth year, some of the stuff he or she learned in year one and two are irrelevant, redundant. So what are we wasting time? So this new concept of nano degrees, micro learning is now becoming very, very popular. Because the good news is that corporates are open to look at what kind of competencies you can bring to the table, not qualifications. They don't care. Companies like Microsoft, Google, SAS, there are many companies who are moving away from the traditional qualification-oriented placements. They say, what can you bring to the table? What can you do? Hit the road running from tomorrow. What kind of competencies? And if you can demonstrate that, bingo, you got a job on your hand. So I think mindset, again, needs to change.
I think that's really interesting you mentioned that, because I think recently, didn't Google launch their own course where they said, hey, it's okay, we're not looking for a 4-degree course, take our competency base. That's really interesting, because now universities are not just competing against each other. Now they're competing against the likes of, these corporates who are saying, hey, we are actually going to disregard. At least back when I had finished my engineering degree, I was speaking to someone on a hiring panel of Infosys. And I asked him a question, hey, you take your, all your new recruits to Mysore, what do you do over there? And that's something really interesting he mentioned. He's like, we teach them to unlearn what they learn, and now we want them to learn what we want them to learn.
Exactly. And so what are we doing? Wasting time 4 years, learning stuff which is irrelevant? There you go. You're right.
Exactly. No, that's fascinating. I know we've been speaking for a long time. There's a couple more questions from my side. One of them is, that's really interesting you mentioned all these concepts. So out of curiosity, where does SPJN fit in terms of how the curriculum is designed? Like, do you actually use some of these concepts and continuously improving your curriculum? Like, just curious to know that.
A very, very important question. So we do it at multiple levels. So one is, in each of our campuses, we have a group of people called the Industry Advisory Board. Now, this Industry Advisory Board is a very powerful body that actually reflects the kind of industries that we want our students to be prepared for. So, for example, in Dubai, we have the chairman of Bain & Company. We have the managing director of Arthur D. Little. We have the chairman of a top financial company. We have the CEO of DHL worldwide and Middle East. So on and so forth. So you're getting the trend now. So similar group we have in Australia, similar in Sydney, and of course, even in India. Now, these are people who are our sounding board. So before we put in an academic program for academic approval with our Australian authorities, it first has to be vetted by the industry professionals. So they would review it and say, these are extremely relevant, cutting-edge, contemporary courses you're teaching. Or they can come and tell us, hey, this is out of date. This has no relevance now. I think you need to knock this out. And we would take cognizance of that and modify the curriculum. The other thing, which is very conscientiously done, is the way we put the curriculum together. It happens at three levels. So one is the concepts, which is fed in by the Industry Advisory Board and the alumni, of course. We also talk a lot. We have crucial conversations with the alumni as to what are the contemporary relevant areas and concepts that they missed out, which they think should be added in. Because they would have missed out because 5 years, 10 years back, that wasn't there. So, you know, I wish I had that in my MBA, that kind of thing. So alums also give that. And then what we do, we look at the relevant technologies. As I said, a few years back, we integrated the latest contemporary technology into all our business courses. So that's part of our DNA. So the technologies, the concepts, technology. And the third bit, which normally people give shortchange or people give, you know, very little importance to, is what we call life skills. Life skills. You know, it's very loosely used to be called soft skills. Public speaking, creativity, problem solving. But we have tied up with India's number one life skills training group called the Harappa Education. Harappa is run by none other than Mr. Dr. Pramod Sinha. Dr. Pramod is the founding director of Indian School of Business and runs a fabulous outfit called Harappa. Harappa is a very interesting term. It's a very ancient term, but you know, very contemporary concepts. So what they do, they have all industry mentors, and the entire program is done by industry mentors. So while the students are learning marketing, accounting, along with the relevant technological inputs, they have a parallel track that they have to pass and passed by Harappa standards to say that, yes, I've done my life skills training. I've done my concepts training. I also have my technology training. So now visualize this student after 1 year, he or she not only is good at finance or marketing or supply chain, but he or she also is a good communicator. He or she is a good problem solver. He or she is a great presenter. So they have all these important skills that they have, working in teams, collaboration. You know, one of the benchmarks we use is what we call skills of the future. And the future is now. So when we say future, it's not future, it's now. World Economic Forum periodically comes out with that framework, skills of the future. And if you see there, unlike a common perception that, oh, it has to be a lot of technology, out of the top 10 skills, only two are technology-based. The others are all human, problem-solving, critical thinking, so on and so forth. So I think we need to take cognizance of that and, again, prepare. So for us, a syllabus or a curriculum is a combination of concepts, combination of relevant technological inputs, and a combination of life skills given in tandem and goes continuous.
Yeah.
And that's
yeah.
the differences.
No, fantastic. That's amazing. I think it's really good. It's really interesting you mentioned speaking to industries and speaking to alumni. Like I did my MBA in a university in London. Anyone can go find out where I did it. I'm not going to say it right now, but the fact is I was very disappointed when I did it, because I didn't speak to anyone from the industry that much. I don't think I spoke to any alumni, and we were still learning a lot of theoretical, stuff that was created decades ago. And I wish someone would have, you know, taken some of these things you're mentioning. And it's interesting because I fell into a world of product management after that, tech product management. Nobody knew product management in university. And, you know, product management is about tech and business and human skills and life skills, as you mentioned. So, me learning just macroeconomics fundamentals were not sufficient to understand presentation skills and negotiation skills, etc. So it's really good to hear that you're trying to cover all these subjects.
In addition, before I forget, there are two other things which we conscientiously embed. So while, you know, we all have guest lectures. Now, guest lectures, we realized, were more a ritual, and you hardly had anybody attending. They would come by choice. So we again flipped it. You know, we're very disruptive in our thinking process. So we said, how do we get everybody to do it? So when I'm doing my design thinking workshop or course, which is for 2 weeks, I have a mandatory guest lecture, a guy who probably works for Lego or a guy who works for IBM's design team who comes and shares. Now, this becomes part of the learning. So it's not a choice. The fellow is sitting inside the class. It's part of his daily attendance. He attends this guest lecture. This is one. The other thing, most of our projects are industry-based. So what we do is, when I do my design thinking workshop, there are two options. Sometimes we do corporate assignments. So much before, weeks before the course starts, we talk to our industry partners. And this could be the Dubai Parks where we've done work. This could be the Atlantis Palm Hotel where we've done work. This could be the Landmark Group with whom we have done work. So it could be any entity. They come to us and say, hey, listen, we have these kind of interesting challenges. Now, these challenges will be posed to the students on day one of the design thinking classes. So they have to work on that in different groups, 4 to 5 members. Then using design thinking tools, frameworks, and approaches, they will try to find solutions. And the best part is the final presentations on the last day of the course will invite all these corporate mentors to come and sit. So we are actually giving live solutions to live problems from the corporate. Students get extremely excited because what they're doing is something real, something relevant. And it further gets validated because the industry is sitting there. They have the mentors who are there, who gave them the problem, looking for ideas, looking for solutions. So it becomes a three-way process and everybody gets benefited. It's a win-win. So, and most of these courses would have these kind of industry embedding. You know, there's a lot of talk about industry academia interface, but I think it has to be done more practically, more diligently, and more conscientiously, which is again where SPJN makes a difference.
No, I think that's fantastic. I think honestly, you got me at design thinking. The fact that, you know, the fact that you know what it means, and I'm not saying this lightly because I worked in different companies as well. And sometimes the CEOs, even tech startups, don't know what design thinking is. So the fact that, you know, you're running a university and you know design thinking and you're actually thinking in terms of more agile ways of working, even in terms of designing the curriculum, it feels like you have taken some of the best, you know, practices of some of the modern companies, how they grew, and you're trying to, you know, include that thinking in how you come up with the curriculum. I think that's really interesting, fascinating. Cool, Dr. Abraham. I think if we talk, we can go on forever. It looks like, you know, we can always cover a range of topics. I'm very conscious of your time. I know in the beginning I said 30 minutes, but this has obviously gone more than 30 minutes. So really enjoyed this chat with you. And any final thoughts from you? Anything that you think you haven't had a chance to cover so far?
One of the areas I speak about is human potential. You know, a lot of times we get influenced by things that happen around us. It could be COVID. It could be Russia's aggression on Ukraine. It could be an economic recession. Now, many times what happens, our thought processes get influenced, rather disrupted by these things that happen around. But I want to share, this is another area of my research, and this is one of my biggest areas where I talk to C-suite executives and I speak to kindergarten kids, that you don't need to lose hope. The history of humanity is a history of struggles against odds. It's just that in the recent past, we have had too much of the wrong kind of media influence, which has had this tremendous impact on our thinking process. We have beaten wars, we have beaten catastrophes, we have beaten economic recessions throughout history. And we're talking about hundreds of years of human history. And so we don't need to worry about it. There is this phenomena called human resilience, the ability to bounce back after a setback, which is biologically inbuilt in each one of us by God Almighty. So we have that power. We have an absolutely awesome brain. Again, we have this huge unwarranted fear against technology. Yes, AI. But if you understand AI, AI is in its nascent stage. It's an artificial narrow intelligence. It has to graduate to artificial general intelligence, after which it graduates to super intelligence, which is dangerous, by the way, which is when computers will start dictating terms on us. But I think, again, we need to be cognizant of it. And we can't be totally, let's say, paranoid about these things. These things will keep coming and going. But we, with the human power, I address a huge groups, the CEO clubs and Rotary clubs, on the awesome potential of the human mind. That our brains are capable of much bigger, much more complex, much more exciting things, and we should never give up. And the other important advice I have, two advices. One is your discipline with digital technology, especially your mobile phones. You know, we all have this fascinating contraption, and we have this morbid obsession with that technology. We need to know how to discipline our relationship. They are great complementarities, but never to replace human intelligence. So we need to know how to discipline ourselves. In fact, I'm addressing a bunch of engineers this coming Friday, how to disconnect from technology to reconnect to our humanity, which was, by the way, one of my TED Talks You know, so
wow.
It's important. We understand that. You know, so that's the first message. Discipline your relationship with technology. The second important thing is how much conscious are you about media and the kind of news that you read from media? Where is your source? Is it credible? Do we have a fact-check mechanism by which we can see it's credible? And be very, let us say, balanced when it comes to getting information. Don't get carried away. Any information, you know, from one side of the political divide to the other side, don't get carried away by media stories. Media has a reason for putting negative stories, but you need to be disciplined. I normally suggest two websites, so maybe if your podcast is listened to youngsters, one is called goodnewsnetwork.org, goodnewsnetwork.org, because in mainstream media across the world, we don't get good news. We only get bad news. There is a war, there is an aggression, and there's a reason behind it. There's a biological reason. Because our brains are hardwired for survival, media likes to give us negative news. So don't get carried away by that. There are wonderful, fascinating things happening in the world. In fact, the last century and this century have been very peaceful centuries, that less number of people have died, though media will hype as if the entire world is going to be annihilated, which is not the truth. So discipline with technology, discipline with media would be two very important advices I have for youngsters. The third one, and I leave you with that, is continuous reading. And that reading need not necessarily be physical books. It can be watching a YouTube. It can be listening to a relevant podcast. It could be watching a TED Talk. It could be any of these ways by which you keep enhancing your learning. And through that, our brain is so fascinating. It's even more complex than the most complex supercomputer in the world. This is as of date, which many people don't know. So the question is, how do we use that awesome human brain, that God-given human brain? And if you know how to use it, infinity is the limit, which is a paradox, by the way.
Wow. No, I think that was fascinating. And I love the energy that you have for the topics that you care about. So I think that was fantastic. Thanks a lot for speaking to us. And thanks a lot for these fantastic insights. Last point is obviously, you know, how do people get to connect with you? How do people know more about you? Like, do you have any, you know, common points you would like to send someone who wants to know more about you?
Yeah, it's www.spjain.org. I'm going to put it on the chat as well, so you can put that on the podcast. Okay, just Google that, and then you've got all the information that they need to know. And then if they are from a particular, because we have multiple campuses, we have multiple recruitment teams that would be responsible for recruitment and admissions. And they can get in touch with them respectively.
Fantastic. And in terms of your personal TED Talks that you mentioned, where do people see that? Are they there somewhere?
YouTube it. Yeah. Just put Dr. Chris Abraham TED Talk or just Dr. Chris, you'll find lots of interesting stuff.
Perfect. All right. Fantastic, Dr. Abraham. Thank you so much for speaking to us. And yeah, have a great day. Have a great week ahead. Thank you so much for this.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me. And good luck and God bless you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the MBA Jam. Now it's time for you to take action. Head over to the MBAJam.com to listen to more episodes and discover great resources.